Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, episode 166, As Long As She's Nice to Look At. Last time, we left off with the starving and desperate Goths agreeing to become vassals of the Roman Empire. In exchange for 600,000 bushels of wheat and the release of the emperor's sister Galla Placidia, and that's Galla, not Gallia, thanks to listener Crispin for catching my random vowel insertion, the Goths agreed to settle where the emperor told them to settle, and fight who the emperor told them to fight. And by the emperor, I of course mean the de facto emperor, Constantius III, who was essentially running the Western Empire at this point in history. Indeed, Constantius's power and prestige will eventually reach such great heights that we will be able to drop the de facto from his title, as Honorius will invite the general to join him in the Imperial College as co-emperor of the Western Empire. But we'll get to that in a second. The land the Romans had dangled out in front of the Goths was the Gallic region of Aquitaine, just north of the Pyrenees along the Atlantic coast. The price for this new homeland would be the destruction of the Vandals and Alans, who still roamed free in Hispania. This price is instructive about the political, military, and demographic realities of the Western Empire in the 5th century. You'll note that the major problem in Hispania is not that barbarian elements had settled down and were drawing taxes and supplies from the local communities. No, the real problem was that they were doing it without having signed some kind of treaty with Ravenna. Over in Gaul, for example, a peace had set in not because the barbarian invaders had been sent running back across the Rhine. Peace had set in because those barbarian invaders had made deals with the emperor that allowed them to stay. Usually those deals were of the land for soldiers variety, but the details varied from tribe to tribe. So the Franks, as you know, already controlled most of northeast Gaul. The Goths are about to control a major chunk of southwest Gaul. And in between, barbarian groups, large and small, were settling into their new homes west of the Rhine. So demographically, the provinces of the Western Empire were undergoing a fairly major transformation. But the key was that this transformation was taking place under the official auspices of the imperial government, which is to say that that quid pro quo was in place: land for the barbarians, soldiers for the empire. In Hispania, no such quid pro quo existed. Well, that's not entirely accurate. Such a quid pro quo had existed, but the deal had been struck with Maximus and Gerontius, rather than Honorius and Constantius. So Ravenna considered the Alans and Vandals to be illegal squatters. And of course, it's not like the Alans and Vandals were helping their cause by diligently passing along taxes. The chronology is a bit muddled here, but it appears that beginning in 416, the year after he capitulated to Constantius, Wallia led the Goths on a campaign that saw them immediately get the better of the Alans, and at least one major faction of the Vandals. Sometime between 416 and 417, the Alans, who had been the most powerful of the tribes in Hispania, were crushed in battle, and their king was killed. Following up on this victory, Wallia moved against a branch of the Vandals who had settled into northern Hispania, crushing them in battle just as they had crushed the Alans. Reports of these victories were music to Constantius's ears, and he rewarded the Goths by granting them the lands he had promised. And so, beginning in 417, the Goths started to migrate over to Aquitaine, the region they would call home for the rest of the century. It is unclear exactly how the settlement and integration of the Goths into the region played out, especially since, you know, there were people already living there. But most likely, the higher status Goths simply took on the role of landlord, accepting the produce of the local communities without actually displacing them from their lands. Meanwhile, the lower status Goths probably would have been moved onto land held by the imperial government, or onto lands that had been forfeited by nobles who, either by death or treason, had lost their deeds during the chaotic last few years. The arrangement wound up working to everyone's benefit, as the Goths now had a stable source of food, and because the Goths now had a stable source of food, the Romans didn't have to worry about them going off pillaging every time they got hungry. While Constantius waited for the Goths to settle in and catch their breath before they headed back into Hispania to finish the job, he attended to some personal business that might potentially have far-reaching consequences for the future of the imperial family and the Western Empire as a whole. In early 417, the Emperor Honorius announced that his finest general would be marrying his only sister, who was now free of the treacherous clutches of the Goths. I can only imagine that Constantius was delighted by this pairing, which made him the brother-in-law of the emperor, and, if all went right, the father of any and all heirs to the Western throne. Galla Placidia, on the other hand, is reported to have been none too thrilled about the prospect of marrying Constantius. And while the specific reasons for her resistance are all speculative, maybe she was still in love with Ataulf. Wherever you see the marriage mentioned, it is always noted that Placidia wed against her will. Which was the nice thing about being a woman in those days. You could be held captive by a horde of barbarians and forced to marry their king. When you're finally given your quote-unquote freedom, you are immediately forced to marry some general you don't know and probably don't like. The Roman world rejoiced when Galla Placidia was set free. How much of a difference in her condition Placidia herself saw between living with the Goths and living at the imperial court would be an interesting question to have an answer to. I would guess, though, that she would say that the baths were better in Ravenna. 9 months after the wedding, Placidia gave birth to a healthy baby girl named Honoria. Unlike Placidia's first child, Honoria would live through her infancy and eventually become an influential imperial princess, although the Ravenna court probably could have done without her most famous intrusion into the treacherous world of international statecraft, which we'll get to when we get to talking about everyone's favorite Hun. In the spring of 418, Constantius was ready to press on with his program of repacifying Hispania, and he called upon the Goths to head back out into battle. However, at some point in here, it ceases to be King Wallia leading the Goths. It is unclear to me whether Wallia fell in battle or simply died of natural causes, but in 418 he goes away and is replaced by Theodoric, one of the illegitimate sons of Alaric. Now Theodoric, as some of you may already be aware, is not going to go the way of Ataulf and Wallia, leading the Goths just long enough to get his footnote in history before dying and passing the footnote on to some obscure successor. No, Theodoric is here to stay, and will not fall for another 30 years, when, in 451, he will die successfully defending the Western Empire from everyone's favorite Hun, thus earning himself a slightly larger footnote in history. Theodoric spent 418 campaigning against the remnants of the Alans and Vandals, driving the survivors south where they joined the ranks of the only major unpacified tribe of Vandals left on the peninsula. These survivors pledged their loyalty to the Vandal King Gunderic, who rechristened himself Gunderic, King of the Vandals and Alans. This reinforced Vandal army was now the last major unpacified barbarian tribe left in the Western Empire. But for whatever reason at this point, major operations in Spain appear to cease. Minor operations will continue for the next few years, but either because the new combined Vandal-Alan army was deemed too powerful to risk battle against, or because the Romans were temporarily satisfied with the territory they had already won back, for the next few years there was no major push to defeat Gunderic's Vandals. And by that point, the Roman High Command ordering said operations looked very different from the one that had kicked off the campaign. Instead of pressing the offensive, the Ravenna court appears to have shifted its focus to reorganizing the provinces that had been lost but were now found. Specifically, Constantius convened a council that would represent the seven Gallic provinces and would meet each year in Arles. The point of the council was twofold. And though these two folds were paradoxical, they were not illogically paradoxical, if that makes any sense at all. On the one hand, the council was meant to give the provinces a huge amount of latitude when it came to governing themselves. The ability of the central authority in Ravenna to micromanage its provinces was long dead. And given the upheavals of the last decade, the imperial court wouldn't even know what was best for the region, let alone how to implement policy. Better to just bring the nobility of Gaul together and let them haggle it out for themselves. The bonus was the increased autonomy also lessened the risk of usurpers popping up, since the wealthy landowners already had a major say in the governance of the region. There would be no reason for them to back some general who promised to protect their interests. Their interests were already protected. The paradoxical part of the fold, though, was that the council was also designed to give Ravenna an increased measure of influence over policy in Gaul. Because it's not like the emperor wasn't going to send his own representatives to the council. With every major player in Gaul in one place at one time, it would be far easier to dictate policy than it would be if everyone had to be contacted individually. So hopefully, the imperial agents of the council would be able to direct the conversation, make the position of the emperor clear, and get everyone on board without having to resort to top-down commands that would alienate the nobility and lead Gaul right back into civil war. Gaining more control by acting less controlling. It's a pretty neat trick if you can get away with it. With the Western Empire slowly coalescing its way back into an orderly state, the promise of more stability to come came in 419 when Galla Placidia gave birth to a healthy baby boy named Flavius Placidius Valentinianus. The boy immediately became the heir presumptive to the throne of the Western Empire and would remain as such unless Honorius planned to find himself a wife and make a baby, which he had shown no interest in doing since he had divorced his last wife, the daughter of Stilicho, back in 408 in the immediate aftermath of the Vandal general's fall. For the record, I don't really know what the story is with Honorius' love life and marital arrangements, but it is entirely possible that the emperor was impotent. That is, after all, how his character and reign are usually figuratively described. So is it really so out there to speculate that he was literally so as well? Anyway, with the birth of the baby history will come to know as Valentinian III, Constantius's position at court was strengthened still further, and in February of 421, Honorius invited his favorite general to take the final step. In a ceremony at Ravenna, Constantius was elevated to the rank of Augustus. This elevation triggered a huge sigh of relief from across the Western Empire. It is always unnerving to have to rely on de facto power arrangements, and once already an eminently capable de facto ruler, namely Stilicho, had been toppled by backstabbers at court, a toppling which had turned out to have had pretty disastrous consequences for the empire. Better to just have your strongest, most capable leader be emperor. And now Constantius was just that. Just as the Valentinian dynasty had been strengthened by the admittance of Theodosius, so too would the Theodosian dynasty be strengthened by the admittance of Constantius III. This was a win-win for everyone. So who could possibly be opposed to this awesome plan? Well, how about the Eastern Emperor, Theodosius II? Now, it's been a couple of episodes since our increasingly Western-focused history of Rome has headed east, so let's go back and bring them up to speed so we can try to make sense of their refusal to accept the elevation of Constantius III to the purple. When last we left them, it was around 408. Arcadius had just died, his 7-year-old son Theodosius II had succeeded him, but power really rested in the hands of the capable Praetorian prefect Anthemius. With a boy emperor in charge of Constantinople, the Hunnic king Uldin You remember him? The guy who had caused Radagaisus's Goths to attempt an invasion of Italy in 405 rather than submit to his rule? Yeah, him. Olden took the arrival of a boy emperor as a sign that it was high time for him to make a play for control over Roman lands south of the Danube. So in 408 or 409, he invaded Moesia. Except, yeah, just because young Theodosius was technically emperor, that did not mean that the kid was actually calling the shots. Anthemius was. And Anthemius quickly and efficiently directed a counterattack, pushing Olden back across the river before the year was out. Coming off this victory, Anthemius received news that was perhaps even better than the news that the Huns were fleeing Moesia. The ongoing negotiations between the Romans and Sassanids had concluded successfully, and a treaty had been signed. The far eastern front was now secure. If Olden thought he detected weakness in the Romans, boy, did he ever read that wrong. Constantinople was now stronger than ever, and free to transfer resources from Syria to the Danube to reinforce the northern line. Olden was kept bottled up on his side of the river until his death in 413, his dreams of controlling all the land under the sun unfulfilled. His death was greeted in Constantinople with delight, doubly so because the Huns Olden had united were not so united without him, and they splintered into three factions. And I don't need to tell you that, man, the less unified the Huns, the better. After the Huns were repelled and the treaty was signed, Anthemius turned his attention to domestic matters and focused on reorganizing the supply chain that kept Constantinople fed with grain from Egypt. 409 had seen yet another shortfall of grain, and a brief famine resulted. But this famine was not caused by a grain shortage so much as by an available transport vessel shortage. So Anthemius expanded the fleet and offered tax breaks to merchants who brought grain to the city. As soon as the bread was flowing again, the prefect started directing portions of the incoming grain to be set aside in an emergency supply to help bridge the gap in case there was a true grain shortage in the future. Anthemius managed to survive long enough to see the completion of the Theodosian walls in 413, but by 414, he suddenly disappears from the historical record without any note of how or when he might have died. Which is too bad, because men like Anthemius deserve better from history. And maybe history felt bad for just erasing him like that, because, as we will see, perhaps in compensation, Anthemius's grandson, also named Anthemius, will rise to become emperor of the Western Empire, serving from 467 to 472, and earning a reputation as the last competent emperor of the Western Empire. Upon Anthemius's death, or at least presumed death, Aelia Pulcheria, the elder sister of 13-year-old Theodosius II, who I briefly mentioned last week, stepped in and assumed the regency of the Eastern Empire, which is kind of a crazy development, since Pulcheria was only 15 years old herself. But apparently, this teenage girl was so remarkably self-assured that she was able to bend the imperial court of Constantinople to her will, despite the handicap of being, well, a 15-year-old girl at a time when I can't imagine the will of a 15-year-old girl counted for much. She had herself declared Augusta, and then took a famous vow of virginity, ordering her two younger sisters to follow suit. There are two intertwined explanations for the vow of virginity. The first being that all three sisters were deeply religious and embraced a monastic lifestyle that was not just limited to sex and marriage. Unlike their mother, who was extravagant to the point of scandal, Pulcheria and her sisters were the exact opposite, removing all the finery Aelia Eudoxia had collected and adopting plain clothes and simple food. But the other reason for the vow was more practical from the standpoint of an ambitious young woman. Marriage meant that she would be subordinated to a husband, and possibly lose all her power and influence. By remaining single, she ensured her independence would not be curtailed. And it never was. She would remain a powerful center of political gravity until her death in 453. Which more or less brings us up to February 421, when word came over from the west that Uncle Honorius had gone ahead and elevated the general Constantius to imperial rank. Now, there is very little explanation for why the court of Constantinople refused to recognize his elevation, but I would speculate that the little clique of imperial siblings were protective of the rights of the blood family. Pulcheria especially might have felt protective, as it is likely she had been propositioned by Anthemius to marry one of his sons as a way to insert Anthemius into the royal family. Pulcheria had rebuffed these advances, and likely saw them as the first step in a possible plan for Anthemius to receive just the kind of imperial promotion Constantius was now receiving, and she didn't like it one bit. The infant, Valentinian III, had a valid claim to the throne, but Constantius, a common soldier from Illyria, not so much. So the Eastern court refused to accept him into their version of the imperial college. While they waited to see how Constantius and Honorius would react to this rebuffing, Pulcheria and Theodosius arranged to expand their purer version of the Theodosian household by locating a proper wife for the now 20-year-old Eastern emperor. But according to legend, Theodosius was not interested in a well-thought-out political marriage to some wealthy senator's daughter. He wanted, quote, a young girl, very comely, the most beautiful ever seen in Constantinople, of royal or patrician family. And if she isn't marvelously good-looking, I have no use for her, however worthy or royal or rich she may be. But whoever was her father, if she is a virgin, and very so good to look at, I will take her. 20-year-old boys, what are you going to do? So when a young Greek girl named Athenais arrived in Constantinople to beg justice from the emperor after getting more or less left out of her father's will despite being unmarried, Elia Pulcheria took one look at her and knew that she had her girl. Theodosius and Athenais were wed in June of 421. No great alliances were formed, no peace was settled, but hey, at least she was hot. Back in Ravenna, Constantius' reaction to the rebuffing was exactly what you might expect. He was furious. Who did these punk kids over in Constantinople think they were? Were there seriously no adults in charge over there? Did they not realize that Honorius was lazy, indifferent, and probably kind of a moron? Constantius becoming emperor was a really good thing, not just for him, but for everyone. In the 10 years or so since Stilicho had died, relations between East and West had improved quite a bit. Anthemius even sent troops to reinforce Honorius during Ravenna's darkest hour, when they were menaced by both Alaric and Constantine III. But the refusal to recognize Constantius blew everything up again, and ever the military man, in the autumn of 421, Constantius began to prepare for war. Or at least make it look like he was preparing for war in order to shake some sense into those no-good kids running Constantinople. We'll never quite be sure if he was really planning to march over to Constantinople and win recognition with the business end of his spear, because in 421, the newly minted co-emperor of the West fell over dead. He had reigned for just 7 months. The empire lost an eminently capable leader, which was bad, but also possibly just missed a civil war between East and West, which was good. Next week, with Honorius continuing to just sort of lounge around in Ravenna like the world's best-dressed couch potato, and the kids in Constantinople playing in the deep end without supervision, things will get a little dicey for the Roman Empire. Theodosius II, for example, is about to chuck the recently signed treaty with Persia that kept the Far East at peace and attempt to start a war with the Sassanids. This war will only be called off on account of a renewed Hunnic threat to Constantinople, which is, duh, exactly why you don't piss off the Sassanids at this point in history. In 423, Honorius will finally do something worthwhile and die, but with Constantius dead and Valentinian III just 2 years old, who's going to lead the Western Empire? Does anyone know? Anyone? Hello? Is this thing on? Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 167, Exploiting the Opportunity. 421 was a busy year for the Roman Empire. The great general Constantius III had been elevated to the rank of co-Augustus in the West, nearly launched an invasion of the East to defend his claim to the throne, and then keeled over dead before winter set in. His would-be opponent in a nearly missed civil war, Theodosius II, had gotten married and then almost immediately announced that his new wife, who had changed her name to Aelia Eudoxia upon marriage, was pregnant with the heir to the Eastern throne. But as these domestic imperial squabbles and celebrations were playing out, events in the Far East threatened to overshadow everything. In early 421, the king of the Sassanids, a moderate, benevolent, and well-respected leader named Yazdegerd, suddenly died. He had ruled since late 399, and among the great political feats to his credit was the fact that he had been the prime mover behind the peace talks with Rome that had concluded with the signing of a treaty in 409. Yazdegerd was succeeded by his son, Bahram V, who, unfortunately, adopted a far less conciliatory posture, and upon his ascension, he immediately launched a program of persecution against any Roman citizen or any Christian living in his kingdom, as he viewed both as potential fifth columnists preparing to fatally weaken the Sassanid Empire. This immediate adoption of anti-Roman, anti-Christian policies was unfortunate all on its own, but it was doubly unfortunate because of who happened to be ruling the Eastern Roman Empire at that exact moment. As we touched on last week, Aelia Pulcheria, who was enormously influential at this point in her brother's reign, was a devout Nicene Christian, and her particular brand of devotion was not limited to the admirable bits about inward piety and outward promotion of beliefs. No, it also included the far less admirable bit about persecuting those who do not share your beliefs. She despised pagans, Jews, and heretics, and took active steps to make sure that they knew exactly how she felt. For example, construction of new synagogues was banned, and in areas where it could be gotten away with without too much civil unrest, existing synagogues were torn down. Pagans, for the first time, were officially barred from holding public office or serving in the military. Up until now, ambitious bureaucrats and soldiers had faced intense peer pressure to convert to Christianity, and at times those who resisted were denied promotion or given crappy assignments, but there had never been an outright ban on pagans serving the state. Aelia Pulcheria ensured that such a ban was now firmly in place. So just at the moment when an anti-Christian king was coming to power in Persia, a fervently pro-Christian Augusta was controlling the Eastern Empire. When she found out that the heathen king of the Sassanids was persecuting her religious brethren, she pressed Theodosius II to do something about it. Theodosius responded by hinting to Bahram, as Constantine had once hinted to Shapur back in 336, that as the leader of world Christianity, the government of Constantinople would take any and all steps necessary to protect the lives, property, and rights of Christians wherever they may dwell. Bahram responded to this threat to his sovereignty by launching a unilateral attack on Roman-held territory along the border between the two great empires. Theodosius ordered his generals in Syria to return fire, and just like that, Rome and Persia were at war again. I do so love it when inflexible people get together like that and really just do the right thing for everyone. Luckily for everyone, the war did not last long. The advancing Persian army was driven back by the Romans, who then proceeded to lay siege to Nisibis until a reinforced Persian army arrived to relieve the city, and the Romans retreated. Hostilities continued into 422, but by then it appears that the leadership of both empires realized what a hopeless waste of time and resources this pointless little war was. The land the Sassanids had typically fought for in the past had been ceded by the Romans way back in the aftermath of Julian the Apostate's invasion. So Bahram was pressing for lands he had almost no political or cultural claim to. The Romans, meanwhile, who would have probably liked to renew their long-abandoned forward bases in Mesopotamia, were suddenly faced with a more dire threat from the north. The Huns were once again crossing the Danube into imperial territory. So cooler heads prevailed, and in 422, the peace treaty between Rome and Persia was renewed, on the same terms that had existed before the recent hostilities had begun. Luckily for Constantinople, the Huns had not regained the sort of unity Olden had been able to forge, and this latest Hun invasion was driven back with, if not ease, then at least not too much difficulty. But though both the major Hun incursions into Roman territory had ultimately been turned back, it was clear that the Huns could not be ignored. Disunited, they were an exhausting foe who would require copious amounts of Roman blood and treasure to keep at bay. Hence the belated realization that, oh my god, we really can't afford a war with the Sassanids. United, well, there was a very real fear in the court of Constantinople that the Romans would not be able to turn the Huns back. While the ministers and generals of the Eastern Empire wrestled with what to do about the Huns, Theodosius II received a surprising letter from his cousin in Ravenna. Not his fellow emperor Honorius, mind you, but the Western emperor's sister, the recently widowed Galla Placidia. The letter said simply that she would be leaving the West and traveling to Constantinople, where she hoped that she and her children would be welcomed with all due hospitality. We do not have a rock-solid explanation for Galla Placidia's decision to suddenly leave Ravenna, but clearly there had been some sort of falling out between her and her brother, and it is sometimes suggested that Honorius had recently begun making untoward advances on his sister, if you catch my drift. It is further noted that this quarrel at the top of the imperial food chain was being felt up and down the ranks. As I've mentioned, and as we'll see again, Placidia had begun gathering up an enormous amount of influence for herself, and she was especially venerated by the auxiliary Goths stationed in Ravenna, who still saw her as something like their queen. So when rumors of Placidia's honor being threatened began to circulate, her supporters were quick to make threats of their own. So it could be that Honorius was actually exiling her to defuse the situation, or that she was leaving because she realized she had become a focal point for possible violence. It is also possible that after a decade spent as a hostage and a political asset to be ordered around at will, the princess was simply looking to break free and establish her independence. Whatever the real reason, Placidia and her two children, 4-year-old Honoria and 3-year-old Valentinian III, sailed for Constantinople either in late 422 or when spring arrived in 423. Their timing could not have been worse. When they arrived in the east, though, everything was still a-okay, and they discovered that the extended imperial family had grown yet again, as Ilya Eudoxia had given birth to a healthy baby girl named Licinia Eudoxia, who would wind up being the only surviving child of the Eastern Emperor Theodosius II. As soon as she was born, the older members of the Theodosian household got together and agreed that when they came of age, that the newborn Licinia would marry her second cousin Valentinian III, arcing the family back in on itself, much as the Julio-Claudians had once so often done. While the East was consumed with shutting down the war with Persia and deflecting the southbound thrust of the Huns, and Galla Placidia was consumed with trying to escape the oppressive atmosphere of Ravenna, the Army of the West was consumed with dramas of its own. Since 411, the Western legions had been unified in form and purpose by the iron will of Constantius III. But now that he was dead, that unity began to unravel. Specifically, there were two officers who had been one step below Constantius III in the chain of command, and who might reasonably presume that their general's death meant that they would rise to fill his shoes. Unfortunately, these two officers, Castinus and Bonifacius, hated each other's guts, which, no, is not good for anyone. The depths of their enmity became known as soon as Constantius was out of the picture. In 422, the forces of the West were ready to make a concerted push into Hispania to defeat the Vandal army led by Gunderic. Castinus led one branch of the Roman army, composed primarily of Gothic auxiliaries, while Bonifacius led another branch, composed mostly of regular legionaries. As soon as they were in country, however, it became clear that the two Roman generals were incapable of working together. They squabbled over strategy and tactics and logistics, all to Gunderic's amusement, no doubt, until Bonifacius declared that he could take it no more and withdrew with his forces south across the Straits of Gibraltar into North Africa. With the Roman forces in Hispania now at least following a single leader, Gunderic's amusement dissipated, and Castinus was able to make inroads against the Vandals and reclaim bits of occupied territory. Gunderic's force was slowly being depleted day by day, and it actually looked pretty bad for the Vandals, until some kind of mutiny broke out in Castinus's army that brought a screeching halt to the whole campaign. It is only mentioned that the Goths under Castinus's command betrayed him. Whatever that actually means, he was forced to withdraw without having finished the job. The next year, Castinus was back in Italy planning the next phase of the operation, when, on August the 15th, 423 AD, the empire was rocked by the shocking news that Honorius had died from what later scholars have diagnosed as edema of the lungs. He was 38 years old and had ruled the Western Empire, though ruled is really not the right word for it, for a kind of astounding 30 years. All of the chaos of the last generation, the usurpations, the invasions, the palace coups, and somehow Honorius had managed to survive it all and die of natural causes. It is probably the single most impressive thing about his imperial career, the simple fact that he managed to live through it at all. Now, of course, as you are well aware, Honorius died without an heir of his own, which, as we've noted, was no big deal these days because we've got a healthy young Valentinian III ready to step in and don the purple. Sure, he was a baby, but of late, the empire had come to accept minority emperors. The point was, Valentinian III was the only living male relative of the dead emperor, and he was the only one with a valid claim to the throne. So, no post-Honorius civil wars for control of the Western Empire, right? Except that, oh yeah, Valentinian III is not in Ravenna, or Italy, or anywhere in the Western Empire. He is in Constantinople with his mother, which is about to complicate things. I would guess that if Valentinian had been older, 15 or 20 or something, there would have been no issue. Word would have come over to Constantinople that Honorius was dead, Valentinian would have sailed at once for Ravenna, and stepped seamlessly into power. But unfortunately, he had not yet been invested with any of the legal titles an heir usually receives. You'll recall, for example, that Honorius himself was likewise a young boy living in Constantinople when his father died, but at that point he had already been made a Caesar and then an Augustus. Valentinian was as of yet neither. The Roman imperial family resembled a traditional royal family in almost every way, but they still define the political power structure by titles rather than by blood. And the scrupulously litigious Romans couldn't help but notice that Valentinian did not yet hold any official title. Everyone had assumed he would take over the West from Honorius, but now that that day was upon them, the matter was suddenly up for debate. And without Galla Placidia and Valentinian physically present in Ravenna to clamp down on nonsense talk and drive the inheritance through, the nobility of Italy began to wonder if there was not an opportunity here to be exploited. The one person who could have really killed this debate was Theodosius II. Now technically the only Augustus in the empire, he would have, by tradition, had the right to nominate his cousin to the now vacant throne in Ravenna. But he declined to do so, possibly thinking that he too had an opportunity here worth exploiting. But without a clear idea of how he wanted to exploit the opportunity, Theodosius's stalling merely emboldened the nobility in Italy to choose their own man. With the general Castinus's backing, the chief notary of the Western Empire, a lifelong bureaucrat named Ioannis, was declared Augustus of the West. This elevation was recognized in Spain, Gaul, and Italy, all territories controlled by Castinus, but it was rejected by the North African provinces, which were under the control of Castinus's rival, Bonifacius. Now, Bonifacius's refusal to recognize Ioannis clearly stemmed, at least in part, from his hatred of Castinus. But Bonifacius had also been helped into his high-ranking position in the army by his friend and benefactor, Galla Placidia. So not only was he 100% opposed to Castinus, he was 100% supportive of the rights of Valentinian III, which meant that Ioannis was never, and I mean never, going to get Bonifacius' support. And Bonifacius controlled North Africa, and as you are no doubt sick of me reminding you, North Africa was where Italy got its food from. So, you guessed it, the minute Ioannis was elevated, Bonifacius cut off the grain. As had been the case when Gildo had cut off the grain during Stilicho's reign, however, the severing of the food supply was not fatal to the self-proclaimed regime in Ravenna. Sure, it undermined Ioannis and Castinus a bit, but it was not so debilitating that it crippled them right then and there. No one outright says this, but I reckon that this means Castinus followed Stilicho's lead and was able to organize relief grain shipments from Gaul to cover the shortfall for the time being. This time being lasted for quite a bit longer than I would have thought Constantinople and the Western allies of the imperial family would have let it, and the entire year of 424 passed without any attempt to dislodge Ioannis being made. There was probably some hope that the crisis could be resolved peacefully, and some fear that peeling off troops to escort Valentinian III to Italy would open up the Danube frontier to another Hun invasion. And so it wasn't until the spring of 425, getting close to 2 years since the death of Honorius, that enough finally became enough. In the meantime, the only concrete step that had been taken to counter Ioannis and Castinus was the elevation of young Valentinian to the imperial rank of Caesar, which gave him the necessary legal authority he needed to claim the throne of the West, when it finally came time for him to make that claim. So as I just said, in the spring of 425, this had all gone on long enough. Constantinople mobilized an expeditionary force under the command of the general Artabor, the man who had just recently led the Roman forces in the Far East during the brief war with Persia. With Valentinian and Galla Placidia in tow, Artabor's mission was to march on Italy, destroy the upstart regime, and install Valentinian on the throne in Ravenna. I'm not sure if the Eastern forces took the land route in through the Alps, or if they sailed their way in, but whichever it was, they managed to penetrate whatever defenses stood against them and establish a foothold on the peninsula. But it was not all smooth sailing, or smooth walking as the case may have been. Shortly after arriving, the armies of East and West fought a brief and inconclusive battle which probably would have passed little noticed were it not for the fact that during the fighting, Artabor was taken prisoner and hauled up to Ravenna. Still holding out hope that if they said and did all the right things that Constantinople would recognize their regime, Ioannis and Castinus decided to let Artabor live as a sign of their good faith, a decision that would prove to be their undoing. While in captivity, Artabor chatted up the guards and ministers who came and went, and he managed to get his hooks into a member of Ioannis' inner circle, probably explaining that it was just a matter of time before the self-proclaimed regime was toppled, and wouldn't it be better to help said toppling and live than to oppose it and die, Artabor convinced the minister to betray Ioannis. Details are sketchy, but the next thing you know, Artabor is free, and Ioannis has been kidnapped from the imperial palaces of Ravenna and spirited off to Aquileia, which the eastern forces had seized control of. Artabor was not interested in showing Ioannis the same consideration that the general himself had been shown after his own capture, and following a prolonged cycle of torture, the would-be emperor was beheaded. With Ioannis dead, the fight went out of his supporters, and they rolled over. Castinus was tracked down and either killed or exiled, depending on which source you read, and I would personally lean toward the former interpretation. And Artabor got green check marks up and down the board. He had marched on Italy, defeated the upstart regime, and placed Valentinian on the throne in Ravenna. Loading next level. The next level began with word coming in that before the eastern forces had arrived, Ioannis had sent one of his commanders off beyond the Danube frontier to raise a relief army from among the Huns, who this particular commander had had fairly extensive contact with during his career. That commander had succeeded in his mission and was now riding into northern Italy at the head of a Hunnic army. But he was exactly 3 days too late, and when the Huns arrived in Ravenna, they found that it had already been seized by Artabor. The question of whether this newly arrived force would carry on the fight hung in the air, until Galla Placidia stepped in and put this little civil war to bed once and for all. The Huns were to be paid handsomely for their time, if they agreed to head back to their homes north of the Danube, and the commander would be given a high-ranking position in the Western legions if he agreed to swear his loyalty to Valentinian. The commander agreed, and the crisis that had been sparked by the death of Honorius was stamped out. So who was this commander, who had been able to mobilize a force of Huns to fight for him, and who was about to become one of the commanders-in-chief in Gaul? He was a one Mr. Flavius Aetius, who was well on his way to becoming the most powerful man in the Western Empire, and the man who would dominate the reign of Valentinian III politically and militarily. Aetius had been born around 390 in Moesia. He was the son of a prominent Dacian soldier and an aristocratic Roman mother. So unlike many of the Illyrian soldiers who had risen to prominence over the years, he did not come from obscure peasant stock. As a result of his essentially noble status, his early years did not follow the same arc as his fellow soldiers, who endured the hardscrabble life of being a poor laborer before escaping into the ranks of the army when they came of age. Aetius was instead considered valuable enough that he was drafted to serve as a hostage on behalf of the Roman Empire. The exchange of hostages between allies, usually children to ensure maximum compliance with the terms of whatever treaty, was an ancient tradition, and in 405, Aetius was one of the hostages sent off by Stilicho to live with Alaric's Goths. The teenager lived with Alaric for 3 years, until in 408, the chaos that resulted from the fall of Stilicho led to his release. Shortly thereafter, he was once again drafted as a hostage and sent to live with a branch of the Huns, who the empire had recently come to an agreement of mutual understanding with. Aetius lived with these Huns for an indeterminate amount of time, but likely for at least a few years, before he returned to Roman territory and followed his father into the army. These early experiences, the positive ties he forged with the barbarian communities he lived with, put Aetius in a unique position to manage the 5th century empire as it wrestled with the question of how to fight and how to live with the barbarian tribes inside and outside of their territory. Next week, Aetius will begin to show his savvy and his mettle when he arrives in Gaul to take over his new command. The Goths, now under the vigorous King Theodoric, had recently grown restless and were looking to expand their territory beyond the confines of Aquitaine. These were, of course, the very same Goths Aetius had spent 3 years of his life living with 20 years earlier, and though he would show a remarkable firmness in putting the Goths back into their place, he recognized the folly of treating them as anything less than a powerful ally who had temporarily overreached. The 5th century was a dangerous place, and enemies lurked behind every shadow. Aetius was going to make darn sure he didn't make new ones if he did not have to, especially when they might be needed to counter the biggest enemy on Aetius's radar. No, not the Huns, or the Vandals, or the Franks, but the general Bonifacius down in North Africa, who despised Aetius as he had despised Castinus, and who would likely stop at nothing until Aetius was driven from power. Welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 168, The Rise of Aetius. In 425 AD, a 6-year-old Valentinian III became emperor of the Western Empire. He shared power with his cousin, the Eastern Emperor Theodosius II, and together they ruled a united Roman Empire that was, territorially speaking, essentially the same empire that had been ruled by Augustus. At least, that's how it looked on paper. In reality, this united empire was anything but, as rival power centers with conflicting interests fought to control their little pieces of the pie and maybe grab some of their neighbor's pie if the opportunity arose. For the time being, the East was doing a better job holding on to their political integrity than the West, but the ministers of Constantinople knew that any major thrust by the Sassanids in the east, or the Huns in the north, would bring it all crashing down. The west, meanwhile, was a mess. The Franks controlled the northeast of Gaul, the Goths controlled the southwest of Gaul, the Vandals controlled whole swaths of Hispania, Bonifacius ruled North Africa as a quasi-independent warlord, while the new commander-in-chief of Gaul, Flavius Aetius, now controlled tens of thousands of troops, and his loyalty to Ravenna was dubious at best. A map of the empire in the 5th century may have looked like a map of the empire during the age of Augustus, but the first emperor, excuse me, first citizen, would not have recognized the land he once ruled. Even in the halls of the imperial palaces, the authority of the emperors was only paper thin, as everyone knew that real power lay in the hands of two women, Valentinian's mother, Galla Placidia, in the west, and Theodosius's sister, Aelia Pulcheria, in the east. This was an empire whose reality was clearly divorced from the happy propaganda offered daily to the public. That, at least, Augustus would have recognized. Of all these competing power centers, the first to butt heads following the ascension of Valentinian III was Aetius and the Goths. In 427, Aetius entered Gaul with a force of about 40,000 soldiers, and discovered that Theodoric had decided to take advantage of the recent chaos in the west and expand his territory beyond the confines of Aquitaine. Specifically, the Goths were in the middle of laying siege to the key Gallic city of Arles. Despite their prolonged intermingling with the Romans, however, The Goths had apparently gotten no better at siegecraft, and by the time Aetius arrived, they had not yet managed to take the city. Aetius's veteran forces were fresh, and easily drove the Goths back into Aquitaine. Aetius made no move to pursue them, or even punish them for their siege. Just a few years removed from the settlement with Constantius, and already the question of the Gothic right to Aquitaine was not at issue. Their only crime was straying beyond the border of their territory. After putting the Goths back to bed, Aetius turned his attention north. Since the barbarian invasion of 406, the power of the Franks had waned a bit after they had been first overrun by their eastern neighbors and then sided with successive losers in the Gallic usurpation wars fought between Constantine III, Gerontius, Jovinus, Ataulf, and Constantius III. But now that things had settled down, the Franks were beginning to reassert their preeminence in northeastern Gaul, which Aetius and the Romans were fine with. Apart from its failure to stop the combined barbarian invasion of 406, the Frankish bulwark along the Rhine had served the empire's interests well. But as we've noted previously, it was imperative that this reassertion of preeminence come under the auspices of the imperial government. It may have been just a veneer of authority, but the veneer was all the Romans had left, and they were willing to fight to protect it. So Aetius marched his forces north and conducted a campaign in 428, during which he defeated a combined Frankish army in battle and secured from them the acknowledgement that yes, Rome is still number one, and we just live here. Aetius also coaxed an agreement from the Goths to provide troops to the Romans if necessary. And of course, by Romans, Aetius meant me. Aetius, you will provide me with troops, should I find it necessary. And he would very shortly find it necessary. After all, Brutus says that Aetius was ambitious, and Brutus is an honorable man. In recognition for his achievements in Gaul over the past 2 years, and to placate a general whose loyalties, as I just mentioned, were a bit suspect, Aetius was elevated to the rank of Magister Militum, making him one of the most senior officers in the Western Empire. I say one of, rather than the most senior officer, because he was still outranked by the senior Magister Militum, Flavius Felix, who had earned his position by way of his friendship with Galla Placidia. But Aetius was a savvy operator, and so, rather than attack a rival who was close at hand and able to defend himself, Aetius attacked a rival who was far away and unable to defend himself. Leveraging his newfound influence, he managed to convince Galla Placidia that Bonifacius was guilty of conspiring against the imperial family. Then, according to Procopius, the Byzantine historian who rode with Belisarius, the sneaky snake Aetius wrote letters to Bonifacius, warning him that Ravenna, for some reason, had decided he was guilty of treason. I don't know where they got that idea from, Aetius wrote, but if Placidia summons you back to court, don't come, because it's a trap. So, of course, when Placidia wrote to Bonifacius asking him to please come to Ravenna and explain himself, Bonifacius froze. It was all unfolding exactly as Aetius had told him it would. And of course it was, because Aetius was working both sides as deviously as a malicious 15-year-old girl with unlimited text messaging. Now, I am not aware of any smoking gun piece of evidence that supports the theory that is usually floated around about what happens next. But the coincidence of events is so strong that it is often simply taken for granted that Bonifacius is the one who invited the Vandals into North Africa. Because in 428, right at the moment when Bonifacius is falling from favor and finding himself isolated politically and militarily, the Vandals suddenly decided to pick up and migrate en masse from Spain to North Africa. And Bonifacius did not lift a finger to stop them. Hence, the assumed theory that the general, desperate for allies and arms, made contact with the new Vandal king Genseric, who had just months before succeeded his late brother Gunderic and offered him land and title in North Africa in exchange for Vandal support in a possible civil war. Now, in the midst of his dark night of the soul, Bonifacius might have thought that inviting the Vandals in was a necessary, even reasonable step to take. But when the dawn came, pick your metaphor, you can't put the genie back in the bottle, or the toothpaste back in the tube, or the Vandals back in Spain. But this theory has been challenged recently for not really making much sense. Bonifacius had been nothing but loyal to the imperial family, and they had, in turn, been nothing but loyal to him. Why would a couple of letters from Aetius, who, you'll recall, had been on the opposite side from Placidia and Bonifacius in the last civil war, suddenly induce him to panic and invite a horde of unpacified Vandals into his territory? The answer is that, well, it probably wouldn't have. And the coincidence of the Vandal migration really was just that, a coincidence. With a new king having just ascended to power, it's not like it would have been far-fetched for the Vandals to choose this particular moment to move on. So, in this less dramatic version, Gunderic dies, and upon taking control of the tribe, Genseric decides to lead them out of Hispania down into North Africa, where the pastures might be greener and easier to harvest. And given that the Romans were about to recognize a Vandal kingdom in North Africa, it's not like Genseric was wrong to try his luck there. This far less fun theory is backed up by what happened next. As I just noted, Bonifacius was a favorite of Galla Placidius. He had refused to recognize Ioannis and done everything in his power to help get Valentinian III onto the throne. So after Aetius made his accusations, the Augusta was left to wonder why Bonifacius would suddenly go rogue now after showing so much loyalty in the past. And the answer she soon arrived at was that Bonifacius had never gone rogue. The charges had rung hollow because they were hollow. So almost as quickly as Bonifacius had fallen from favor, he flew right back up into it. Not only does the rapidity of this turnaround point to an underlying trust between Placidia and Bonifacius that could not be so easily shaken, but it also leaves very little time for Bonifacius to make his alleged invitation to the Vandals. Whether he did or did not invite them to come down to North Africa, however, one thing is very clear. In the late 420s, the Vandals came down to North Africa. When Bonifacius heard they were making the crossing from Hispania, he ordered them to turn around at once. But Genseric simply ignored him. The Vandals were in the process of migrating en masse, giving up their land and strategic positions in Spain in the process. They had no intention of going back. So now Bonifacius had himself a little problem. What do you do when 80,000 Vandals say that we're here to stay, and what are you going to do about it? While Bonifacius was figuring out what to do about it, Aetius returned to Gaul, where he was once again forced to confront an expansionist-minded Theodoric. Around 430, a second battle was fought near the city of Arles, whose outcome was the same as the first time around. The Goths were driven back into Aquitaine. This time, however, Aetius forced Theodoric to sign a formal peace deal, reinforcing the terms the Goths and Romans had previously agreed on. The original deal had been struck by Ataulf and Constantius, neither of whom were still alive. So now the deal was restruck between Theodoric and Aetius, and maybe that would keep the Goths where the Goths belonged. And maybe, since he was being so lenient, Aetius would be able to count on the loyalty of Theodoric and the might of Gothic arms should the need arise. Having come to terms once again with the Goths, Aetius turned his attention to a more pressing matter. It appeared that Galla Placidia had gotten wise to his double dealings over Bonifacius. The details of all this are muddled, but it appears likely that Placidia, hip to Aetius's shenanigans, ordered the senior magister militum Flavius Felix to take care of his two-faced colleague. Aetius was then probably warned that he was under some kind of secret death sentence, because guys like Aetius always have spies everywhere, and so he decided to strike first. When Felix traveled to Gaul in May of 430, Aetius sprung trumped-up treason charges on his senior colleague. Refusing to let the no-good traitor Felix time to wriggle away from the righteous hand of justice, and by that I mean contact Placidia and calmly explain the situation, Aetius had the senior general executed immediately. Galla Placidia was now in a bind. It was clear that Aetius was conniving and backstabbing his way up the chain of command, but there was very little that she could do about it. As charismatic as he was methodical, Aetius had secured the loyalty of practically every soldier under arms from Spain to Gaul, barbarian auxiliary, regular legionary, whichever. So the Augusta couldn't just move against him without risking him taking that final step and invading Italy. Her only hope lay in Bonifacius, but unfortunately, he was busy grappling with the Vandals. Having crossed over the Strait of Gibraltar, Genseric had led his people on a steady march east until by early 430 they were on the border of Numidia, knocking on the door of the heart of Roman North Africa. Bonifacius led an army out to meet them, but the Roman forces proved insufficient. Even though the Vandals only had something like 15 to 20,000 fighting men, that was still more than anything Bonifacius could muster. After the Roman army was scattered, the Vandals kept moving, and by the spring of 430, they were besieging the city of Hippo, trapping the elderly Bishop Augustine inside. Facing the destruction of his city by barbarian Vandals, who, to add insult to injury, had all converted to the heretical sect of Arianism, Augustine entered into terminal decline, and in August of 430, died before the siege could be lifted. But the siege would eventually be lifted, though it was only a temporary reprieve. Hippo eventually did fall to the Vandals. But in the subsequent sacking, the heretic Genseric was careful to protect Augustine's library and his church. Such was the reputation of the great doctor, even after his death. With his rival general under siege in North Africa, Aetius was in no rush to force a confrontation with Placidia for control of the West. Instead, he spent almost all of 431 traveling first to the Rhine frontier, and then up through Noricum to the Danube frontier. At every stop along the way, he secured agreements from local Roman officers and local barbarian chieftains to support him personally in case of emergency. By 432, he was back along the lower Rhine, conducting a second campaign against the Franks, again, not to defeat them in any meaningful way, but just to kick them around enough to make them pledge to supply troops should Aetius call for them. By 432, the situation in North Africa was still grim, but it appears that grim had become the new normal. Most of the key Roman cities were able, for now, to resist Vandal siege, and the Vandals were not so numerous that they could just flood the countryside and envelop the whole continent all at once. In any case, nothing was happening in North Africa in 432 that was so pressing that it stopped Galla Placidia from recalling Bonifacius to Ravenna. Apparently realizing that time was playing into Aetius's hands far more than hers, Placidia decided that she needed to act now or risk losing her status without Aetius ever needing to pull his sword. When Bonifacius arrived in Ravenna, the imperial court made a great show of welcoming him, and it was shortly announced that he had been elevated to the rank of senior magister militum. So, question for the Augusta. What does that mean for Aetius, the current senior magister militum? Oh, he's been fired. Oh, I see. Well, good luck with that. I think I'm going to go take cover now. Aetius, as you can well imagine, did not take his sacking lying down. Indeed, as soon as he got the news, he mobilized his forces and marched them into Italy. But a funny thing happened on Aetius's irresistible march to the pinnacle of power and prestige. Confronted along the road between Ravenna and Rimini by hastily mustered Italian forces under the command of Bonifacius, Aetius lost the battle. Stone cold lost the battle. Stripped of his command, Aetius was now little more than a fugitive. And so he did what fugitives so often do. He ran for it. And he didn't stop running until he knew he was someplace where the long arm of the imperial court could not reach him. In this case, that someplace was the territory of the Huns, north of the Danube. Having lived with them for years, and fought alongside them ever since, Aetius was free to walk among the Huns as almost no other high-ranking Roman was able to do. Among them, he was safe, and among them, he could plot his revenge. In this plotting, Aetius had an ally in the Hunnic king Rua, or Rugila, depending on which book you're reading. Since about 420, Rua had co-ruled a major faction of the Huns with his brother Oktar. But since his brother's death, Rua had been the sole king of what was fast becoming a united Hun confederacy. The friendly ties between Aetius and Rua were long-standing, as it appears that Aetius's years as a hostage had been spent in the same Hun group that Rua had been a rising noble in. Once before, Aetius had shown up on his doorstep asking for a Hun army to back him in a Roman civil war, and that time around, no blood had been shed, and the Huns had been paid well for doing nothing more than walking to Italy and then walking back. This time around, the situation was clearly more dire for Aetius personally, and real fighting might be required. But Rua was still happy to provide his old friend with the troops he needed. The possible upside was too tantalizing to pass up. If Aetius won, he would be the master of the Western Empire. And who doesn't like being close personal friends with the master of the Western Empire? Meanwhile, back in Italy, it became clear that Bonifacius's victory had not come without a price. The general himself had been wounded in the fighting, and after lingering for a few months, Bonifacius succumbed to his injuries in the autumn of 432. He was succeeded by his son Sebastianus, whose first assignment was to ensure that Aetius stayed exiled. In this, he was entirely unsuccessful. It is unclear to me whether Aetius returned to Italy in late 432 or early 433, but whichever it was, when he did come back, he came at the head of a powerful Hun army. This new army easily swept aside the Italian forces, and Aetius forced his way into Ravenna, where he humbly asked to be reinstated to his old position. And how could Placidius say no, what with how nicely Aetius was asking and all? Aetius completed his takeover of the West by taking title of all the lands that had been owned by Bonifacius, and then, kind of creepily, marrying his late rival's widow, which I can't imagine was any fun for her at all. So now Aetius was the most powerful soldier and statesman in the West. He was, just as Rua had hoped, the master of the Western Empire. And Flavius Aetius would not relinquish this title for a good 20 years, making him easily one of the most important men of the 5th century, and, when you get right down to it, one of the most important men in the whole of Roman history. He would manage the West through its final phase of semi-stability, and then successfully see it through one last great crisis before he died. That crisis, of course, has a name and a face, and they will be shown to us for the first time next week. Because as happy as Rua must have been to see his old friend Aetius attain such great heights, he did not live to enjoy the fruits of his friendship. Dying in 434, Rua would be succeeded by his two nephews, an elder brother known as Bleda, or Buda, whose name, incidentally, is where scholars think the Buddha in Budapest is derived from, and a younger brother, whose name is synonymous with all that is great and terrible, Attila the Hun. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 169, Huns and Vandals and Goths, Oh My. As you know, the Huns have been playing a major role in Roman politics for the last 50 years at least. Arriving on the Hungarian plain back in the 370s, the Huns sparked a multi-generational migration of the former native tribes of the region into Roman territory, which led to, among other things, the Battle of Adrianople, the mass invasion of 406, the sack of Rome, and now the Vandal takeover of North Africa. This is to say nothing of the endless revolts, civil wars, and assassinations all this demographic unrest had forced the Romans to deal with within their own ranks. But for the most part, the Hun impact on the Roman world had thus far been indirect. Aside from the brief abortive thrusts of Olden in the early 400s, the Huns had basically stayed on the north side of the Danube River. Their arrival in the west was an epoch-defining event for the Romans, sure, but mostly in a domino-toppling sort of way, rather than a I'm-punching-you-directly-in-the-face sort of way. But that was all about to change. New leaders were about to take over the Huns, and new leadership meant new policies, and new policies meant new headaches for the Roman Empire. Headaches caused by repeated Hun punches to the face. When Olden died in 412, you'll recall that his coalition split into three major factions. Each pursued its own course and was led by its own leaders for the next decade or so. But by the mid-420s, they began recoalescing around a pair of brother kings, who I introduced briefly last week, Oktar and Rua. This recentralization of Hun power naturally led the brothers to think up ways to use their new strength to their advantage, and they hit upon the idea of making the Romans pay for the privilege of not being attacked. I don't know if they ever actually planned to follow through on the threats they began issuing to Constantinople, but I kind of like to think that they didn't. That Rua and Oktar were fine with just sitting around doing nothing, and were like, hey, the Romans don't know that we're fine with just sitting around and doing nothing, so let's see if we can trick them into forking over a bunch of gold. At some point in the mid-420s, they sent envoys down to Constantinople demanding an annual payment of 350 pounds of gold, or we will invade your empire. Yeah, that's the ticket. Do you think they bought it? The Romans did indeed buy it. 350 pounds of gold was a lot, but not backbreaking, and the Huns were awfully menacing, what with their ridiculous horsemanship and crazy accurate archers. So Theodosius II's ministers agreed to the terms, and for the next decade sent along the gold every year, and in return the Huns kept right on doing nothing. Which is pretty good work, if you can get it. This new status quo endured through Oktar's death around 430, and continued unchanged until the end of Rua's life in 434. Now, it is fairly easy to draw a line in the sand between Rua and Oktar on one side and Bleda and Attila on the other and say, well, on this side the Huns were content to indirectly influence Roman politics, and on this side they dove headfirst into direct action. But it's not quite that simple. For one thing, when you get right down to it, granting Aetius's request for a field army to go drive Bonifacius from power isn't exactly indirect influence. But you could make the case that it really was. But what is less debatable is the fact that Rua almost certainly died on the Roman side of the Danube. And what was he doing on the Roman side of the Danube? Was he on some diplomatic mission, doing some sightseeing? No, he was leading a Hun invasion of Moesia. So the aggressive posture of the Huns in the middle 5th century cannot be solely attributed to Attila. Clearly, they were moving in that direction already. But that said, Attila and his brother Bleda were definitely more aggressive than Rua and Oktar had been. This most recent campaign into Roman territory, for example, was mostly a case of hot pursuit taking the Huns across the border than it was an attack on the Romans per se. A few subject tribes had tried to break free of Hun domination by fleeing into the empire, and rather than let them go, Rua had launched a pursuit. International borders and treaties be damned. So when he died, and Bleda and Attila succeeded him, they and a Hun army were actually in Roman territory, which the court of Constantinople was not at all happy about. But when imperial envoys went out to remind Rua that, hey, this is exactly the sort of thing we've been paying you not to do, they were greeted and said by the newly ascended kings Bleda and Attila, who were looking to flex their muscles politically. The brothers were happy to leave, they said, but only after the Romans agreed to double the annual indemnity to 700 pounds of gold and open up Roman markets to Hun traders without barrier or restriction. 700 pounds of gold was a lot more than 350 pounds of gold, but given the circumstances and a cold calculation of how disastrous a prolonged war with the Huns would be, the envoys agreed to the terms, and the Huns withdrew back to their side of the Danube. Satisfied with the barrel they had just laid the Romans over, Bleda and Attila let the empire alone for the time being, and instead turned their attention to the other great gold egg-laying goose, the Sassanids. And though it would be 5 years before the Huns turned their attention back to Rome, Attila had learned a very specific lesson from this first encounter with the Romans. They could be pushed around, and fairly easily at that. Now, one of the circumstances that had led Constantinople to so readily agree to pay the Huns rather than fight them was the fact that they had recently dispatched a good chunk of their available forces to take care of a problem that technically wasn't really their problem at all. But given how depleted and at each other's throats the Western forces were, somebody had to do something about the Vandal invasion of North Africa. So in 431, Theodosius II had sent troops to North Africa to deal with what was really his cousin Valentinian's problem. The Eastern expedition was led by the general Aspar, who was the son of Artabor, the general who had gotten Valentinian onto the throne in the first place. Aspar and his men were not able to roll back the Vandal tide, but they were able to stabilize the situation and pave the way for a treaty between Ravenna and the Vandals. Brokered by Aspar in 435, the treaty ceded the Vandals control of Numidia. In exchange, the Vandals agreed to stay out of the province of Africa, thus preserving, at least for now, Italy's access to the grain it so badly needed. Deal with this Vandals in hand, Flavius Aetius, now the dominant general and statesman in the West, was able to turn his attention back to Gaul, which he was intent on reimposing order upon. If he could get a permanent handle on the myriad independent tribes who now form the core of the region's population, he might be able to turn his attention more fully to North Africa and expel the Vandals once and for all. But despite his best efforts, the provinces of Western Europe would remain a slippery snake that would defy Aetius' attempt to turn his back on them time and time again. This time, it was the Burgundians in northern Gaul who raised Aetius' blood pressure. Having been granted lands by Honorius in the settlements following the fall of Jovinus, the Burgundians were now looking to extend their territory westward and began menacing their neighbors in Gallia Belgica. Aetius led a Roman army against the Burgundians in 436, and the general succeeded in pushing them back into their agreed-upon place in the world. The victory was complete enough that the Burgundians agreed not only to stay put, but also to pay what amounted to a fine for breaking the peace. Thinking that this was the end of it, the Roman army withdrew, and the Burgundians got to work hustling up the cash they had agreed to pay. But that was not the end of it, at least not for Aetius. Agreements were nice, but agreements could be broken. Aetius wanted a more permanent solution to the problem of Burgundian aggression. So he contacted some old friends in the Huns and asked them if they wanted to make a quick buck. The job was simple. Ride into the territory of the Burgundians and slaughter them. Every last one of them. The Huns agreed because it's not like they had scruples about this sort of thing. And in 437, a horde of them rode into town at high speed and commenced a slaughtering. Some 20,000 Burgundians were killed in the ensuing massacre, including the old king Gundahar, who, you'll recall, was once upon a time one of the major powers backing Jovinus. The Huns did not succeed in snuffing out every last man, woman, and child, but as you can imagine, it would be a while before the Burgundians caused any trouble for the Romans again. While this slaughter was unfolding, Aetius, Galla Placidia, Valentinian III, and the rest of the Western court were off on a holiday to Constantinople. You may not have noticed because, like his uncle Honorius, Valentinian III isn't really much of an emperor, so he gets properly relegated to the background of his own reign, but the boy has grown up and just celebrated his 18th birthday. So the family traveled to Constantinople to consummate the agreement made by Galla Placidia and Aelia Pulcheria way back in the early 420s. In mid-437, 18-year-old Valentinian III married his 15-year-old cousin, Licinia Eudoxia. With the two halves of the Theodosian family reunited, everyone could rest easy, knowing that the future of the dynasty was in safe hands. What's that you say? Valentinian III and Theodosius II are actually destined to be the last blood emperors of the Theodosian dynasty? Surely not. We've got two of them. Teenagers, mind you, all set to keep this thing in the family. It's not going to work out, huh? Well, okay, that should be an interesting and bloody transition when we get to it. Staying in the East for the moment, the next year saw the publication of Theodosius II's one true contribution to world history, a contribution that was apparently undertaken of his own initiative. Though the Theodosian walls that bear his name are undoubtedly more famous, the walls are his in name only, as he was just a kid when they were completed by the Praetorian prefect Anthemius. But with the publication in 438 of the Code of Theodosius, the Eastern Emperor finally had something he could point to and say, "That was me. I did that." The code was the culmination of nearly a decade's work. In 429, Theodosius had appointed a commission to track down and compile every single law, decree, edict, or opinion issued by Roman emperors since 313 AD. Why 313? Well, if you'll recall, that was the year after Constantine defeated Maxentius at the Milvian Bridge, an occasion now understood to mark the beginning of the Christian Roman Empire. Concerned that the empire's laws had become unwieldy and disorganized, Theodosius wanted to create a single source that would define the empire politically, economically, religiously, and culturally for generations to come. Most especially, the personally pious Theodosius wanted to establish once and for all that Orthodox Christianity and imperial rule were inseparable. Two sides of the same coin. Published in 16 volumes, the code was immediately useful to jurists, but still led to complications and confusion. Focused almost exclusively on compiling a century's worth of scattered laws, Theodosius's commission declined to include any sort of explanatory commentary to help lawyers interpret the raw decrees. The commission further declined to even make editorial decisions about which of two contradictory laws to include in the code, throwing both in if each was found to be independently authentic. As a result, the main legacy of the Theodosian Code was not that it in itself became a lawyer's Bible, but rather that it forms a huge chunk of the Code of Justinian. Compiled and written a century later, the Justinian Code did become a lawyer's Bible that included helpful commentary and a rationalized set of laws that eliminated as many contradictions as they could find, all tasks made infinitely easier by the initial work done by Theodosius's commission in the 5th century. So good work, Theodosius II. You alone among your 5th century imperial brothers have managed to do something useful, and dare I say beneficial, for your people. While Theodosius was basking in the glow of his own usefulness, Aetius was back in Gaul in 438, trying to keep a handle on the anarchic mess that was the Western Empire. Suffice it to say, the Theodosian Code is not going to be minded much around these parts anytime soon. For the rest of the year, Aetius campaigned against one of those still loose tribes that had come over in 406 and still held on to some territory in Hispania, and the Goths, who were once again trying to break out of the confines of Aquitaine. More than anything else, the Gothic king Theodoric wanted to seize the lands to the south of Aquitaine and win control of a Mediterranean port for his people, and he must have figured that eventually the Romans would be spread thin enough that he'd be able to break through. But Aetius himself faced off against Theodoric and once again defeated the Goths in battle. Theodoric offered terms of peace, but these were apparently rejected by the Romans as being too lenient. So in 439, the Goths went back on the offensive. This time, however, with Aetius back in Italy, the Roman counterattack was led by a subordinate general who was beaten, captured, and who then died in Gothic captivity. The Romans were then forced to agree to terms with the Goths that were even more lenient than the terms they had rejected as too lenient just the year before. A Gallo-Roman senator named Avitus brokered a deal that likely involved the Romans recognizing the official independence of the Goths. That same Avitus would later play a key role in swinging Theodoric and the Goths to the Roman side during the Hun invasion of the early 450s, and then a few years after that, ascending to the imperial throne as a part of that interesting and bloody post-Valentinian III transition I just hinted at. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. That same year saw the Western Empire dealt another setback. Watching as the Romans continued to be tied down with conflicts in the north, the Vandal king Genseric decided that he had nothing to gain by adhering to the terms of the treaty he had signed with Rome 4 years earlier. Staying put in Numidia would just make him a chump, because after all, the rest of North Africa was just there for the taking. No reason not to go for it. It's not like the Romans are going to be able to do anything about it anyway. So in 439, Genseric crossed the border into the province of Africa. Taken completely by surprise, the thoroughly inadequate African garrisons proved no match for the Vandals, and the barbarians were able to waltz right into Carthage without even putting it to a siege. With the entire North African coastline, from the Atlantic to modern Tunisia, now under his control, Genseric's ambitions grew proportionally. Snatch-and-grab sackings were fine for nomadic tribes living a predatory existence, but Genseric now fancied himself a civilized king of civilized lands. So rather than terrorizing the citizens of Carthage, Genseric instead embraced them as his new loyal subjects, and declared that Carthage would now be the capital of a great Vandal kingdom. Surprised by this turn of events, the Romanized North Africans, well, embraced their new self-proclaimed king right back. It's not like Ravenna had been much for worrying about their needs lately. Despite the fact that the Vandals had been menacing their homes for the last decade, Ravenna had refused to prioritize North African interests, choosing instead to focus on the crises consuming continental Europe. Now that the Vandals had basically won, the citizens of North Africa greeted Genseric's decision to transform himself into a civilized king who respected the civilized rights of civilized people with hope. If the Vandal king really wanted to make a go of it, the people of North Africa were basically ready to support him. The Romans had abdicated their responsibilities, so they were owed no more loyalty. Genseric's occupation of North Africa may have been just that, an occupation, but it was not the most actively opposed occupation of all time. With the help of his new subjects, Genseric began to build a massive fleet of ships to fulfill his dreams of further conquest. Though the Vandals had no real experience with seafaring, Genseric was determined to use the ports of North Africa as a launching pad for the maritime conquest of the Mediterranean Sea. In less than a year, Vandal ships launched from Carthage and landed on Sicily, where they began a systematic seizure of the island. From there, they continued to branch out over the next few years, taking control of Sardinia, Corsica, and the Balearic Islands. The ease with which the Vandals were able to control the Mediterranean is impressive, given, as I just mentioned, they were not exactly a seagoing people. The Phoenicians, they were not. But their exploits should not be too overblown. It had been centuries since the Romans had had to deal with a hostile power roaming our sea, and the Imperial Navy was not the most built-up or well-trained branch of the armed services. The sudden emergence of Vandal pirates swarming over the islands of the Mediterranean was unprecedented, and no one quite knew how to deal with them. In a very real way, Rome was right back where it was before the Punic Wars, with a hostile power based in North Africa, controlling the seas and menacing the Italian coastline. Except that instead of being on the rising tide of the bell curve, the Romans are now on the receding side. I'm sure the ghost of Hannibal looked on with approval, as this time the North African maritime power would not be turned back, and instead overwhelm the Romans and eventually sack the Eternal City, fulfilling the centuries-gone dream of the Barker clan. But that, too, is for another busy day. Just as had happened after the Vandals initially crossed over into North Africa, their entrance onto the waterways of the Mediterranean caught the attention of Constantinople, and in 441, Theodosius II ordered an expedition to try to stamp them out. But after getting as far as Sicily, this expedition was recalled to the east. After 5 years of fighting in and around Armenia without making any appreciable gains, the Huns decided that Rome was a far easier target than Sassanid Persia, and returned to the Danube frontier thirsty for blood and treasure. And as if that wasn't bad enough, the removal of the Hun threat freed up the Sassanid forces, who, possibly acting at the prompting of Vandal ambassadors, started attacking Roman positions along the eastern border. With the Persians attacking in the far east, Bleda and Attila decided that the time was ripe to squeeze a little bit more juice out of the empire, and so they began attacking Roman positions along the northern border. Next week, this will all come to a head. Though the Sassanid threat will quickly dissipate, the Vandals were still growing strong, and the Hun threat was just getting warmed up. Indeed, next week we will see the first major successful Hun invasion of the empire. Previous attempts had been half-hearted and short-lived, but this time the Huns meant business, and their ravaging of Moesia and Thrace in the early 440s will firmly cement the legend in the mind of every Roman that the Huns were as horrifying as they were invincible. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 170, Attila Cometh. So last week, we saw how the myriad external pressures on the Roman Empire threatened to crack it up completely. But you may have noticed that these external pressures were falling unevenly on the two administrative halves of the empire. Sadly, by the mid-5th century, the Western Empire had become little more than a semi-functional confederation of barbarian tribes, with the imperial court at Ravenna sort of managing to cling at some semblance of its former prestige. Huge swaths of what had once been a truly united political entity were now autonomous zones run with little regard for the emperor's authority. In contrast, the Eastern Empire was doing pretty well for itself, all things considering. Since hitting rock bottom with the double blow of Julian's failed campaign against the Sassanids in the late 360s and the Gothic War of the late 370s, the East had actually rebounded nicely. I don't mean to imply that the 5th century was some kind of picnic for Constantinople, but you just don't see the succession of, and then they signed a treaty giving away Egypt, and then they signed a treaty giving away Greece, and then they signed a treaty giving away Cappadocia, the way you do with the West. But this week, the hammer, or should I say the scourge, is about to drop on the East as hard as it ever fell on the West. And though Constantinople isn't about to lose control of any land, it is going to cost them a pretty penny to hang on to what's theirs, because Attila the Hun drives a hard bargain. So you'll recall from last week that through the 430s and into the early 440s, the Eastern Empire was feeling secure enough in its own position that it was sending troops to the West to help contain the Vandals in North Africa. Now, this was not a purely altruistic act. Vandals spreading across North Africa means Vandals might eventually reach Egypt, which is a totally unacceptable development. Plus, Vandal pirates disrupting shipping lanes was bad for everyone's business, both East and West alike. But though containing the Vandals was most certainly in the best strategic interests of Constantinople, it was in a long-term preventative sort of way. That luxury of being able to think long-term came to a screeching halt in 441, when the Eastern Empire was simultaneously attacked on two fronts by its two biggest potential enemies, the Sassanids in the far east and the Huns in the north. Suddenly, stripping off soldiers from the Danube frontier and sending them off to Sicily to fight Vandals seemed like a really, really poor decision. Now, just to get this out of the way, the Sassanid threat receded almost as quickly as it advanced. It is possible that their brief offensive against Roman positions in Armenia had been launched at the behest of Vandal ambassadors who were looking to tie down Constantinople while Genseric moved to annex the province of Africa. But it appears that the Persian heart was never really in the attack. Becoming embroiled in a major war with the Romans just so some ill-mannered barbarians could seize some land on the other side of the Mediterranean was no one's idea of good policy. And so the Sassanids withdrew almost as quickly as they had advanced. Not that the Vandals minded, if they really were behind the brief campaign. By that point, Constantinople had its hands full anyway, so Sassanid aggression was no longer required, because the Huns were feeling aggressive all on their own. The Huns had returned to the Danube frontier in force after 5 years of fruitless campaigning against the Persians, likely hoping that they would be able to extract from the Sassanids the same sort of indemnity deal they had already extracted from Constantinople. The Huns were now returning to the Hungarian plain, disappointed men. I'm just speculating here, but I have to believe that 5 years' worth of futile campaigning in the East played a role in Bleda and Attila's decision to adopt a far more hostile posture towards the Romans when they returned. It seems reasonable that there would have been a fair amount of grumbling about the costly boondoggle the brother kings had just retreated from with nothing to show for it. How long would the brothers be tolerated if they didn't bring home some bacon? And soon. So in 441, the Huns crossed the Danube and began sacking Roman cities and towns, Make no mistake about it. This time there was no cover story about pursuing wayward vassals. This was a straight-up invasion of Roman territory with the intent of carting off any riches contained therein. Well, that's not exactly right. Carting off the riches contained therein was a nice bonus, but it's pretty clear that the attacks were mostly about forcing Constantinople to once again increase the annual indemnity it paid to the Huns. After all, attacks, campaigns, and battles risked Hun lives and treasure. But sitting around while the weak-willed and frightened Romans hand-delivered wagons full of gold, that risked almost nothing. So why conquer Rome when you can just turn it into a tax-paying vassal? So through 441 and 442, the Huns commenced a series of hit-and-run raids to remind Constantinople just how insecure their borders were, especially after they had foolishly sent that expedition off to the west to fight the Vandals. Driving the point home that this time the Huns really meant business, the strongest and most important cities of the Upper Danube were targeted, including the old imperial capital of Sirmium, which the Huns stormed in the late summer of 442. The Romans attempted to resist, but having lost valuable resources to the expeditionary force, they were simply no match. The Hun army rolled right across Dacia and Moesia, sacking almost every major city along the way, which was, without question, the single most shocking and terrifying development to Roman war planners. You'll recall that the dynamic of the Gothic War after the Battle of Adrianople was that Fritigern and his Goths had the run of the open plains, but that they were unable to take any of the cities since their siege craft was real amateur hour stuff. So as bad as it got, the Goths could never close the deal, a fact everyone eventually recognized and a fact that led the Goths to finally accept Theodosius's peace overtures. So when the Huns first started pouring across the Danube, it is entirely likely that the Roman high command thought that the same rules would apply. Okay, we get the people and the food behind the walls, the Huns run around for a little while, it'll be rotten, but we'll get through it. But to their very great horror, the Huns breached the walls of the first city they hit, and then the next city they hit, and then the next city they hit. This is what really launched the Huns into being nightmarish monsters from hell. You couldn't hide from them anywhere. So far as I can tell, there is no obvious explanation for why the Huns were so much better at siegecraft than any other barbarian tribe. But they were. And there is speculation that their recurrent service with Aetius and the other Roman generals over the last 30 years had led them to pick up a trick or two. And though that may be the best rationale, it doesn't really explain why the Goths remained so rotten at breaking into walled cities after they had served in and around the Roman legions for the last 50 years. So it is a bit of a mystery why the Huns were able to crack the nut that so far no other barbarian nation had been able to crack. Even the Vandals down in North Africa owed their occupation of Carthage more to intimidation and betrayal than to brute force. Faced with the stark reality of Hun power, the wind went out of Theodosius II's sails. He absolutely had to get the Huns to stop their attacks. His armies couldn't stop them, his walls couldn't stop them, so it would have to be the cash. As I said, Attila and Bleda were not messing around this time, and after proving beyond any doubt that they could pretty much do whatever they want, whenever they wanted, it was going to cost the Romans to get them to stop doing whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted. For starters, that annual indemnity that you've been paying, cross out 700 pounds of gold and double it to 1,400 pounds of gold. Got it? Okay, next, we have captured just scads of prisoners. Really, we've got more of them than we know what to do with. Now we can either kill them or we'll sell them back to you. Say at 12 solidi a head. A mere pittance, we agree, but we're feeling generous. So, are we all good here? Just go ahead and put the gold over there. There you go. That's a good little Roman. The Huns, temporarily good to their word, withdrew back across the Danube after the money was delivered. But the resulting peace cannot have felt at all secure to Constantinople. The Eastern legions had been utterly shown up. The defenses of key cities had been breached, and the economy of the Central Empire was thrashed and about to be overtaxed to pay the Huns to stay out. And perhaps most frightening of all, when you got right down to it, nothing more than a handshake prevented the Huns from just coming right back over the Danube. But the Huns were more honorable than the Romans perhaps gave them credit for, and they did indeed stay out of Roman territory for the next few years. It wouldn't be until the Romans broke the terms of the treaty that the Huns again launched themselves on an invasion. This time, one that would take them to the walls of Constantinople itself. While the Central Empire was being ravaged by the Huns, Flavius Aetius was doing his best to keep a handle on things in the West, which these days had less to do with thinking up sound laws and running a competent administration, and more to do with managing an increasingly complicated system of treaties with recent barbarian immigrants. In 442, when it became clear that no more help would be coming from the East, thanks to the Hun invasion, Aetius was forced to formally recognize Vandal dominion over North Africa. Now, I know what you're thinking, but it looks as though included in the treaty was a promise from the Vandals to continue the grain shipments to Italy, at least in part. Which makes sense when you think about it. The economy of North Africa revolved around supplying Italy with food. For Genseric to simply declare a trade embargo would have caused economic chaos in the lands he was now trying to rule, probably to the point that his new regime would have been fatally destabilized. Plus, cutting off the grain would have essentially forced Ravenna to launch a full-scale war against the Vandals, which was not at all in Genseric's best interests. But the deal did not just leave the status quo in place, because not accounted for in the treaty was the tax revenue generated by all that agricultural production and trade. That Genseric claimed for himself, cutting off yet another huge source of imperial revenue. So the Italians would not starve to death, but it was getting damn hard for them to afford stuff, like, you know, standing armies. This revised treaty with the Vandals in place, Aetius spent the next few years in Gaul and Hispania, attempting to hold on to what little tax-paying territory Ravenna had left. What remained of the Burgundians were rounded up in 443 and force-marched south, where they were settled south of Lake Geneva. Aetius then led Roman forces against rebellions, incursions, and criminality of every shape and size. Through the mid-440s, he fought the Franks and Alans, both of whom were trying to carve out larger niches for themselves than Aetius could responsibly allow. He also had to deal with homegrown gangs of marauders, who had grown into fairly large and organized bands. Their homes overrun and the economy in tatters, many dispossessed Gallo-Romans joined up with these gangs and started causing all sorts of additional havoc for Aetius, not just with their persistent harassment of what was left of the law-abiding citizens of the region, but also because they were a constant threat to his supply and communication lines as Aetius tried to wage small-scale wars on multiple fronts against multiple enemies. But despite the fact that he had so many balls in the air, by all accounts, Aetius did a remarkable job holding things together. Sure, he dropped North Africa, which I should mention is the single biggest criticism leveled against him by historians in an otherwise unanimous flood of glowing praise. But other than that one glaring omission, he managed the European provinces about as well as you could hope, given the resources at his disposal. At the very least, it's impressive that there was even still a Western Empire for Attila to invade here in a couple of years, and even more impressive than that, that there was still a Western Empire left after Attila came and went, which Aetius gets and deserves most of the credit for. Speaking of Attila, After waltzing through the Middle Empire as easily as if they had entered in some kind of cheat code, he and his brother led the Huns back north across the Danube in 444. After settling back down, however, the nearly inevitable result of having co-rulers occurred, and the brothers appear to have turned on one another, each seeking sole control of the Hun nation. At least, that's what we presume happened, because in 445, Bleda suddenly drops dead, and the universal assumption is that Attila had his brother killed. Now the sole ruler of the premier military power in the wider Mediterranean world, Attila kicked back to enjoy the fruits of his labor. Except that Theodosius and his ministers down in Constantinople decided that the cracking of solidarity between the two brothers hinted at a larger fracturing of Hun unity. Piecing together the cause and effect of all of this is no easy job, but it looks like the Romans decided to test their theory of internal discord among the Huns by abruptly cutting off the indemnity payments. Or, based on some math that we'll get to in a second, that they never actually started sending them at all, counting on the new rivalry between Attila and Bleda to keep the Huns too busy to worry about a few missed carts of gold. By 447, though, Attila had emerged victorious from the power struggle, consolidated his authority over the whole Hun nation, and was now free to wonder where his money is. The reason it is questioned whether the Romans ever sent along a payment after the settlement of 442-443 is because of the initial demand Attila delivered to the Romans in early 447. His ambassadors to Constantinople presented a bill to Theodosius for 6,000 pounds of gold, which, when you do the math, covers 4 years' worth of missed Roman payments. The Romans rejected the demand. They had had 4 years to consolidate their power along the Danube and were itching to see if they could permanently refuse the Hun legbreakers. So in early 447, the Roman bill still unpaid, Attila once again led his forces on a sweeping invasion of the Central Empire. Once again, the Roman forces were made to look like fools. 4 years of planning and entrenchment had amounted to exactly nothing. A Roman field army met the Huns near the river Eutus, and though they were able to inflict more damage on the Huns than any Roman force had ever before inflicted on Attila, the legions were soon overwhelmed and scattered, which left the road to Constantinople wide open. And that was exactly the road Attila intended to take. It was time to plant a flag in the emperor's backyard. And his timing could not have been better, because on January the 27th, 447 AD, a massive earthquake struck Constantinople, and, you guessed it, the Theodosian walls were severely damaged. Broken, crumbled, with enormous gaping holes. This looked like it could spell the end for the capital city. Attila the Hun, was on his way at the head of an army that had thus far proved totally invincible. And the only hope of the city, the Theodosian walls, was now a broken shell of its former self. And it's not like the people of Constantinople were going to get the fortifications rebuilt before the Huns arrived, unless, of course, they did. In one of the most remarkable feats of the ancient world, engineers and laborers, half out of their minds with fear, worked around the clock at a frantic pace to put the Theodosian walls back together. In March of 447, with Attila still maybe 100 miles out, the last brick was laid. In just 2 months, the citizens of Constantinople had completely rebuilt the Theodosian walls. And as a result, they now stood a reasonably good chance of turning Attila back. Fear, as has been shown in study after study, is probably the single greatest motivator in all the world. When Attila reached Constantinople in mid-447, a Roman army was mustered to oppose him, but the Huns promptly blew through them without even breaking a sweat. This was almost to be expected. Then everyone held their breath to see what would happen next, Would the new walls hold? The Huns attacked and were repulsed. They attacked some more and were repulsed some more. There was nothing the Huns could do. The Theodosian walls were impregnable. Attila had taken Sirmium and Nisus and Philippopolis and every other Roman city he had ever laid eyes on. But when he hit the Theodosian walls, he was stopped dead in his tracks. So, just like every other invading army that would come and go over the next 1,000 years, the Huns were forced to withdraw from Constantinople. But just because there was this one thing on Earth that could stop the Huns, that didn't mean that there was anything else on Earth that could stop the Huns. By the end of 447, Attila was on the other side of the Sea of Marmara, near the entrance to the Hellespont, when he encountered a second branch of the Eastern Army. This army fared no better than their brothers had fared at Eutus and in front of Constantinople. The Huns blasted them to smithereens. The East was now essentially left without any field armies, and aside from the Theodosian walls, left without any way to defend itself. What in the world were they going to do now? That question is going to have to wait for next time. And unfortunately, next time is going to have to wait a few weeks. I know you are as surprised to hear this as I am to say it, but the next History of Rome tour has arrived. We will be gone from February the 24th through March the 6th, so the next episode of the History of Rome is tentatively scheduled for March the 12th, which will be the Sunday after I get back. I'm hoping I'll be able to turn that episode around for you so I don't disappear off the grid forever, but life is quite a bit more hectic these days than it used to be, so you never know. If the episode on March 12 is not going to happen, I promise I'll let you know as soon as I know, and I also promise that I'll have a darn good reason for not doing it. For those of you who are going on the tour, I can't wait to meet you. For those of you who aren't going on the tour, be sure to stop by thehistoryofrometour.com. Drop us a line and let us know that you're super sad you aren't going this time around, but can't wait to find out when the next tour is so that you and your whole family can come along. The History of Rome tour is super fun, and I think everyone who has done it so far will attest to that. So, I will see you in a few weeks, and for some of you, I will see you in a few days.